The current controversial play, if it is a play, technically it isn't really possible to put it down the heading of a play. If a play is defined as usually, because play is normally said to have elements of conflict in it, there must be some forces opposing some other forces. And in this particular presentation, the element of conflict is remarkably lacking. The two chief figures are merely waiting. There's no element of conflict in them, unless you like to think of some very indecisive thoughts of possible suicide. And the other two figures are not in conflict, because one of them is completely subservient to the other. The author of this play has made a statement to producers that the producers should see that the actors do not try to find out what the play is about, that they do not think about the meaning of their characters, and that they just do it. He has also said that Godot is not to be equated with God. Now, if we are not to think about meaning, and we're not to make equations, then the play must either be meaningless, or it must have such a meaning that the author doesn't wish to make two play. Now, various suggestions have been made about this play, and most of them are based on somebody's analysis centered on one character or another. There's been no attempt to explain the whole structure of the play in general terms. If we look at the structure of the play as evidence in the dialogue itself, we find that the two chief characters, the waiters, show in their dialogue a remarkable similarity to the two thieves that are crucified with Christ. One of them continuously refers to this fact of the thieves, and also to the fact that one thief is penitent and the other thief is not. Now, if we look at the play as a whole, we find five characters in it, two waiters, and one power man, and one slave, and a child. The child himself is the key, because he represents the childlike mind, and he is the only one who has seen Godot. Now, the author of this play says we are not to equate Godot with God, and he must have a reason for saying so. Obviously, he doesn't want to antagonize people directly. Maybe he has some respect for his ribs. It is possible that physical violence might be done to the author if he were openly to state one of the meanings of this play. Suppose we say immediately that the child in the dialogue says he has seen Godot, and that Godot is doing nothing. Have you seen Godot? Yes. What is he doing? He is doing nothing. Now, this makes Godot remarkably like God, apart from the fact that he has whiskers. God, the infinite, does nothing, if we use the word does correctly. To do is to finite. I can imagine I'll try to use a piece of chalk now. As soon as we put down the letter D, we have put down the glyph of division, and therefore of finiting processes. So the verb to do implies that the continuous nature of the absolute shall be divided. So to do is to finite. Now this child says he has seen Godot, no doubt with the innocent eye, and he has seen Godot doing nothing. That is to say, not doing. That is to say, not finiting. Now, the particular waiter who asks the child, "Have you seen God?" says to the child, "You have seen me, haven't you?" He says, "Do remember you've seen me. Bear witness that we were waiting. Let God know that we are waiting." Now this is a key to the mentality of the waiters in general. Let's put the waiters over here on the sinister side, because if you remember, the sinister side is the side of the have-nots, the side of the weak. These waiters are tramps. These tramps are men who do not fit in with the social pattern. They haven't got a social position. They do not work within the social framework. They are not definable in social terms. In Old Testament terms, they are sojourners, not dwellers in the land. Abraham is a sojourner, not a dweller in the land. He keeps on the move. He is a tramp. But Abraham has a very good reason to keep on the move. He knows that in any finite place, the divinity there worshipped is a local divinity conditioned by the locale, the forces of that terrain. You know that monotheism itself arose with a people who were on the move. If we take the Jews coming out of Egypt and wandering about in the desert and eventually breaking their way into the Promised Land, we find a people who have a God who is not localized. And this fact that the God is not localized is, if you like, the beginning of an absolute monotheism. He's an extraterritorial God. All the other gods have the characteristics of the places in which they dwell, in which their worshippers dwell. Thus in an oasis, the God is a kind God, and in a desert, the God is a harsh God. Now, if you're going to wander about and you need a governing concept with you, you will have to have a governing concept that is not tied down to the characteristics of any particular locality. So that you need a God who is not merely the God of an oasis or the God of a desert, which you can take as the two types of environment, nice environment, horrid environment. And you need a God able to cover both of these. And we find this Old Testament God to be a God of love and a God of wrath. He's a God of the oasis and he's a God of the desert. He combines all the characteristics of all the localities in which these lonely people go. And there is something positive about it. Abraham and his descendants, in wandering from place to place, are picking up the best qualities of all the local gods and enrolling up all these best qualities into a unific concept of a supreme God, a God beyond all gods. And therefore their kind of tramping about is justified, it's positive. They are collecting useful data and combining these data into a grand concept of a universal Lord embodying all characteristics. They're positive tramps, like Abraham. But in waiting for God, the tramps are not positive, they're negative. They are tramps who wait for God. Let's say that God means, if he also says it doesn't mean God, we won't quarrel with him. We'll say it means that being which, when he comes, will sort everything out and make it very nice. That's the definition of the Messiah at his second coming. He will sort everything out. He will wipe away all tears from their eyes. So God means, whether it means God in inverted commas or not, he who, when he comes, will sort everything out and make it very nice for us. And the waiters, therefore, represent all those people who actually believe that there is a Saviour who is going to come and make everything very rosy. And yet, although they're supposed to believe this, and they wait, they do nothing about it. They don't fit in with social moralities or ethics, they don't fit in with social work, they don't coordinate themselves with other human beings, and worst of all, they don't wait positively. They're forever despairing and thinking whether they should commit suicide or not. They're always finding bits of things to do to polish themselves off. But they're not even positive about that. The rope they get breaks. And so they have to postpone it till tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow and so on. These waiters, these trans, are asocial beings of a negative order who can't even wait positively for the second coming of the Messiah. They can't wait for he who is going to put all things right when he comes in a positive mood. They're not the virgins with their lamps trimmed with oil. If they're virgins at all, they're the ones that haven't got any oil in their can and get caught out because they've done nothing. So these two particular tramps represent all religious people who wait for the Messiah and do nothing about it. They do nothing to put themselves in order, they just wait and assume that when he comes, because they said they were waiting, they're going to be treated all right as good waiters. And so he says to the child, "You have seen us. You have seen me, haven't you?" He makes the child bear witness that they waited, so that when the child goes to Godot, he will tell Godot, "There are some people waiting for you to come." But Godot, he who will sort everything out when he comes, doesn't really like the people that wait passively and do nothing about anything. And so these two particular characters, the penitent and the impenitent thief, are in no sense positive, and we can say quite simply, they're no good. They don't impress us with their strength of purpose, their strength of waiting, but rather with their vacillation. Simply, we could say they are all religious people, religion in inverted commas, all religious people who, in their waiting, wait negatively and in a vacillating state and contemplate suicide and whether it's worthwhile. They're not positive waiters, they're negative waiters. Short, we would say they are all no good waiting religionists. Now, obviously, the author is not going to stick his neck out in public and say these two tramps represent those people who believe in God and believe he's going to come again, believe that there will come he who will sort everything out and wipe away all tears from their eyes. And these people are no good. He's not going to say to the audience, "All you who go to church, all you who don't go to church, who believe in religion and who are waiting for somebody to come and sort things out and are doing nothing about it, are no good." That would cross off a large number of the audience and lose their sympathy. We then go to two other characters. There's Potso. We can say quite shortly, he means pots of money, pots of land. He, in every sense, is the successful man who has amassed wealth, riches, and authority. This man, as portrayed in the various versions, is always roughly the same. He's a man of accomplishments, a man of authority, a man of force, a man of wealth. And chiefly, he's a man who employs a slave. And this is the key to his later blindness. Potso is a power man. He gives orders. He shouts people down. But as a result of his accepting the slavery of his bag carrier, he becomes blind. He can't see the fact because he has tied himself to a slave. He has not encouraged this slave to become free, and he has not freed himself from the slave. This is his big crime. He is no good because in accepting this slavery, he has enslaved himself to the slave. He has to hold on to the other end of the rope that is tied around the slave's neck. So again, the author would have to say something like this: Potso is the businessman, or the landed gentleman, certainly the wealthy man of authority, who in accepting the slavery of others has tied himself to a slave and has blinded himself to the higher possibilities of freedom. So he would have to say all those members of the audience who employ labor, who shout down their labor, who browbeat their labor, who encourage their labor to remain labor, to remain subservient, are all no good. He's going to lose the sympathy of a large number of members of the audience again. He's lost 2/3 of his audience now. Now, the slave is lucky. He symbolizes all those people who think the pools might turn up next week and that this will somehow solve their problem. Lucky represents all people who are waiting for luck to turn up for them, and then they're going to do some undefined. But meanwhile, they are carrying the bags for Potter. They're carrying the bags of sand, of worthless matter, for their boss. And he can't put down these bags. And the problem is raised by the tramps, why doesn't he put the bags down? Many reasons are given why he doesn't put the bags down. You could say he doesn't put the bags down, basically, because he doesn't want to. Why doesn't he want to? If he puts the bags down, he will not be working for somebody. If he's not to work for somebody, then he must use his own initiative. But using his own initiative requires him to know where he's going, requires him to think. And we see the kind of thing that happens when he tries to think. On being commanded, think, he starts. His machinery turns over, and out of his memory stores, there begins to churn a series of words, which get progressively more and more impressive, more and more complicated, more and more rapid, until they mechanically turn into an overheated performance, finishing up in pure frenzy. Now, it is a fact that large numbers of people, when they try to think, and I mean to think to some purpose, on any definite subject in a continuous line, get overheated brains. They get hot-headed, and if they persist, they really do become frenzied. Such people exist. Here the author is saying, the other members of the audience not yet covered by the first two categories are also no good because they are waiting for the pools to turn up, or for a lucky dog or a lucky horse, but certainly it must be lucky, and they are in time of waiting for something to turn up, willing to be dependent on a man who is willing to depend on a slave. And to this end, for the security's sake, for their daily bread's sake, they are prepared to stand any insult whatever heaped upon them by the boss. So this particular character is also no good. Now, an audience is generally composed of three types of people: religious people, successful business people, and unsuccessful people, and which we may class as ordinary workers, lucky folk. So if you proceed to say that these three categories of people are no good openly, then you've said in effect to your audience, you're all no good. Now, on the first night of the presentation of this play, put clearly in this manner, when the author comes on at the end of the play to take a bow, it is highly probable that the audience will proceed to deposit upon him whatever they've got loose that is stolen. He has said that religious people who wait for the second coming of the Messiah, people who do nothing about themselves, do nothing about each other, but just wait, are no good. He said that businessmen who employ people and keep them enslaved are also no good, that they go blind to the truth of humanity, blind to the possibilities of freedom, and that they finish up being dragged about by their slaves and led by their slaves because they're holding on to the other end of a rope tied around the neck of the slave who is stumbling about dumb. The slave has become dumb because he has stopped articulating, stopped talking to himself about who he is and what he is and what his duties are. So when we look at these four characters, we can only say that they're a queer lot, a negative lot. They're not nice. Because of this lack of positivity in them, the true elements of conflict in a real drama are absent. And it has been said that this isn't a play at all, really, because it lacks the elements of conflict. Everybody's negative. The one positive thing in it, the child runs away in fright because of the queer behavior of the waiters. altogether, this is a very, very negative play. It's a play that says part truths about people. If we say, here is one human being, and we cut him into three parts, we can write in one part the businessman, we can write in another part the waiters for the second coming, and we can write the slaves in another part. Now, every man has these three parts inside himself, and if he doesn't know about it, he is likely to suffer these three negativities in himself. There's a businessman derived from Cain here, who counts everything up. There is a waiter who is a half man, and a slave who is a belly man. So we can say the businessman is the head man. The waiters, who are supposed to love God, are half men, and the slaves are belly men. Now these three are parts of one man, and therefore, in this negative aspect, this play represents a negative man. It has no solution to offer. No mode is pointed whereby these things can be integrated and conquered. The fourth method of integration is not stated. And the one thing that might have been positive to child, instead of growing up, runs away in fear. The statement from our point of view is, we can use this peculiarly negative play, and like every other negative, we can turn it into a positive deliberately by simply seeing it for what it is and then inverting it. There is a businessman inside us. This businessman counts its own advantage all the time, and it is prepared to utilize other people. Not simply the people that it pays regular wages to, but any other people at all. The businessman in us is prepared to count up exactly how much energy, how much thought, feeling and will we are to put into a relation with another person in order to force that other person to serve our purposes. In other words, to enslave another person. This relation is not simply that between businessmen and workers. It is a relationship between all people who count, keep account of events and energy expenditures, and then, by means of this counting, try to force the behavior of other people into subservience. That's the one side of it. Self-examination will show that in the man who is not perfectly integrated, not fused, these business entities constitute a separate category of sub-ends that count to their own end all the time and utilize other people as means to their end. And in so doing, these counters, because they count serially, are always counting after the fact, and they find themselves tied to the persons whom they are trying to enslave. A person that tries emotional blackmail on another person is enslaving himself to that person in the very attempt to enslave. At the same time, there's an element in us, the slave element, the belly element, that for the sake of appetite of three orders, for the sake of sexual appetite, for the sake of belonging appetite, belonging to the tribe, and for the sake of the appetite for food, for these three appetites, there's something in us that if it operates separately as a sub-end, will stand any insult whatever and will allow itself to have a rope round its neck and to be directed by the counting mechanism in the head. This belly impulse will keep us enslaved and will obey all the counting processes of the head that seem to indicate to the belly how to get sex, belongingness or fulfillment of herd instinct, and food. All the securities of relation are in this slave. This slave follows a serial process of thought, the businessman, hoping that this serial process of thought will show it how to fulfill its three basic appetites. The appetite for food, the appetite for belongingness, warmth, tribal identity, and sex. And it will follow any serial thought that appears to it to direct it in the way he wants to go. And also there is in the feeling, in the heart level, when it operates independently, separately, there is a tendency not to drive like the belly slaves do, to obey the serial thought of the head, and not to think like the head does, but simply to feel and hope, a funny feeling, a feeling of hope, that someday, somehow, it will work out all right in the end, and meanwhile we are waiting for that time. Somehow, says the waiter of the heart, even if I can't think properly, or if it's too hard for me to think, even if I've got no belly urge, if I just have faith in the second coming, it will be enough. I don't need to do anything about it. I don't need to think anything about it. I'll just wait and be justified by my preparedness to wait. But unfortunately, the condition of this waiting of the heart is continuously influenced by two factors. That is, the factor of the belly condition, the slave, whether he's well fed or ill fed, and the factor of the businessman, whether he's a clear thinker or an obscure thinker. If he thinks badly, then the slave element lacks its dinning. If he doesn't get his dinner, he gets depressed. And if he gets depressed, then the weights to the heart want to hang themselves. But they haven't got enough energy and they never have the right rope. So they always do it tomorrow and tomorrow. So we see here that we can convert this negative play into a positive one by saying to ourselves that we, knowing these facts, can oppose in ourselves the counting serial activities that utilize the belly urges for their own ambitions, the slave activities of the belly that are prepared to follow serial thought, providing it leads to satisfaction of the belly, and the waiters of the heart, who being devoid of the energy of the belly and devoid of the clarity of the head, think to save themselves by a peculiar species of thought called faith, and this faith itself is not even positive enough for them to hang themselves efficiently. Here then, by this threefold statement, we have a key to the kind of work we've got to do. We must cut down on serial thought, the businessman, eliminate him by not being determined by serial processes built on past experience and projected into the future. We must not let the belly elements obey stray thoughts in the head, serial processes of thought, in the hope that they will get what they want, because the thought processes in the head are always after the fact. They're too late, they're not immediate, they're not on the ball. And we must conquer this tendency to wait in a vacillating manner, negatively, and do nothing. Here are the three processes. Certainly we can say that is the meaning of waiting for Godot that the author would not like to present clearly to any audience, because of its basic unacceptability. You can imagine what it would be like if it were presented in a clear form to an average audience. They would all be very annoyed, and it is extremely unlikely that the audience would refrain from throwing things at the author when he appeared at the end of the play. Now, have we anything to say about this?
What did the child mean when it spoke of Godot beating his brother?
And Godot beating his brother? In what sense?
I don't know. Alice Charles had a brother who Godot beat and slapped in the head off him. He said, I'm not too certain on the exact words.
But again, you've got a very primitive reference here to the splitting, the two sons, if you like, the Christ figure and the Luciferian figure. One of these figures, they're brothers, see, Christ and Luciferian are brothers. One of these figures gets badly treated. Why does he do it? Here we have to go into the whole metaphysics of existence. We'll start again with the plain paper. The plain paper represents the absolute. If it doesn't move at all, it makes nothing, and if it makes nothing, there is no value. If it does move, it conditions itself by its own movement. To symbolize the creation of finites by this movement, we use the sign of Saturn. And Saturn represents that centripetal force that precipitates all points of matter. Now, this particular sun himself is the devil, but he is the bright morning star prior to the fall. Prior to this compression, there is a zone of energy which is radiating. But when it's radiating, it's called Jupiter. So that this Luciferian figure in its radiating phase, in its expanding phase from the center, is like God the Father. And this Jupiter, God the Father, creates for himself a sun by pressing on the center, and then presses through the center to come out again. Now you notice in Burma's terminology that Jupiter, God the Father, is used for that phase of motion that follows the Saturnine compression. He wants to explain the expanding force, and he knows he can't explain expansion without positing contraction. If we start with the paper without motion at all, with neither expansion nor contraction, we're not allowed to draw a symbol at all. And consequently, when we want to start, the head of the series is the point that we draw. But that point is already a finite zone. And yet it is a necessity to press in order to press out. So the peculiar thing is this, that Jupiter, the outpressing, is placed by Vernon as after Saturn. And yet, in an absolute sense, Jupiter is before Saturn. It is Jupiter, God the Father, who is the field prior to the Saturnine impression. When the compression of the forces of the field occurs, it is called Saturn. And when it expands after the contraction, it is then called Jupiter. And it is returning to the original state of non-contraction. And yet, prior to the contraction, it has no name because it is neither expanded nor contracted. The principle, the first, is the head of a series. And Saturn is the head of serial processes and is therefore equated with time. Prior to the head of the series is that which is before series. That which is before series is the absolute simultaneous eternal. If we take a series of sticks and lay them out, one after the other, if we get fairly close to them and focus on one, we can put down one, then put two, three, four, and so on. But if we stand back, we can see all these things simultaneously. And this is a power we have. If you are sufficiently far away, you can see 10 strokes at once. But if you get very close up and bring your eye very near to the board, you can't see 10 strokes at once. And consequently, when you're very close in, that is contracted, you are in serial mode. And therefore the serial mode, the temporal mode, the principle, the first, is the head of a series. And Saturn is the head of serial processes and is therefore equated with time. prior to the head of the series is that which is before series. That which is before series is the absolute simultaneous eternal. If we take a series of states and lay them out, one after the other, if we get fairly close to them and focus on one, we can put down one, then put two, three, four, and so on. But if we stand back, we can see all these things simultaneously. And this is a power we have. If you're sufficiently far away, you can see 10 strokes at once. But if you get very close up and bring your eye very near to the board, you can't see 10 strokes at once. And consequently, when you're very close in, that is contracted, you are in serial mode. And therefore the serial mode, the temporal mode, depends upon contraction of the field of observation. If you expand your field, you are moving away from seriality. And if you remove contraction completely, you are in eternity. That is in simultaneity of perception. So Saturn as the head of the series seems to be a psychological necessity. We must finite the field of awareness, bring it to a point in order to create seriality. As soon as we let the contraction of the field go, we are moving towards eternity. And when the contraction is completely gone, we are already in eternity. Now this ties up with what immortality is. Immortality is indestructibility. The mort, the death, means the substance, the violent vibration of the substance, and the crucifixion. It means that apparently continuous substance, M, is violently vibrating, R, and the vibrations go to their term and break into 10 points. Each one is fixed by the crossing of these forces, and therefore in its fixation is the true term of death. It can't move. The division has come to the term. And the way to conquer mortality is quite simply to conquer seriality. When we contract our perceptual mode and bring it down to a tiny point, in the act of focusing it, we have excluded everything else. And in this act, because to focus in this way is to finite, if we stay on that point, hold it, we are then in the state called by the psychologist a fixated state, we are stuck monomediastically on it, we are dead. Life is movement. And so if we concentrate on one of a series, a finite, and hold it so that nothing happens, we are dead. And this really is the only kind of death there is, fixation on samsara. Now, a man with a slightly larger outlook might draw his circle a bit bigger and embrace 3 such units. But again, if he embraces these 3 only and holds them in static relation, then he is dead. Now, because the holding process is Saturnine, and the Saturn is only a contraction of the field, because it has a beginning, it must have an end. So that every started contraction, every contraction initiated, must ultimately be undone. And in this undoing process of the identification is the mortality. At some point, that which has been bound together must break, because the Saturnine or concentrating forces have to let go. Now it doesn't matter how big the zone held by the Saturnine concentration, no matter how big it is, no matter how much energy we put into it, if it is finite, we will ultimately have to let go. If it is serial, it is temporary. If it is temporal, serial, finite. It has a beginning and it must therefore have an end. At some point we will have to let go of it, and it then lapses back, and we have lost this individuated thing, and this is another kind of death. The first kind of death is fixation on a finite form, and the second kind of death is the loss of pattern, a gestalt, an integrated pattern and form. If we get 3 points, force them into a triangular relation, and bind them together in such, we've made an individual called a triangle. We have forced them by the shattering power of our concentration into this pattern, and as long as we can do, we have made an individual, a triangular individual. While we are on it in the temporal process, concentrating, we are dead. We are dead in the fixated sense. But when our energy runs out and we have to let go, then we die in another sense. That is, the thing breaks. The finitely integrated, the temporally integrated, must at last break up. So we have two kinds of death here. The death of fixation on a finite, and the death of the dissolution of the finite. Now, dialectically and logically, if a man, by the force of his Saturnine concentration, brings a pattern into being, if he likes it, loves it, worships it, as long as that pattern can be held, he is happy. But because it has a beginning in time, it has an end. It must break. And according to the degree with which he has worshipped it, so will be the degree of his sorrow when at its term it dissolves, it breaks in bits. If we like, we could call this pair of deaths the first death and the second death. The first death, the death of fixation. The second death, the death of dissolution of the fixated. They are both painful in their own way, to be fixated on a finite, to bound one's mental horizon, to become blind to all else, is painful. And to see one's treasured finite dissolve before one's eyes is also painful. There's a relation here between the second death and that second death that it says, they shall not be hurt at the second death who give themselves to the Logos. As the Logos is a sphere, universal, which is held in being by the will of the Absolute, and it's the Logos Son, that's the brother of the Luciferian. This Logos Son, the Christ Son, the Sophic sphere in one of its aspects, this is already a formal procedure which will not disintegrate because it has never been serialized. Now, if we identify with the Logos sphere, because it is an eternally vibrating sphere, and that with which we identify we become, we become one with that eternal sphere, and then for us there is not a death of the second order. That is not a death of dissolution. The way then to defeat mortality is simply by defeating seriality, temporality. And the way to do that is by climbing up to the Logos level, where the forms that are perceived are eternally vibrating forms, kept in being by the absolute sentient power called God the Father. So this Logos sphere is that sun. The force outside here is the Jupiter, and the force in the center here is the Saturn. This Saturn is the sun of God, precipitated as a center of reference. And between Saturn and Jupiter arises the spin, which we call Mercury, and which is the brother of Saturn and is also a son of God. Now, one of the sons has been kicked down by God, and one of them has not. But the one that has not has to go down and come up again, eternally. He goes down to hell and up to heaven, and in this continuous crucifixion, burial and resurrection is counterfeit to the Logos life of the cosmos.
Why would some people come away from that kind of the feeling of positivity? Some people I've spoken to about it felt elated.
I would say that where people are elated by that, they've been doing this inversion process in some measure, or they have been making what are called odious comparisons. They have detected some of the people they know in the play. Now this came out very, very strongly in bed yesterday. Those who felt cheerful about it thought they had detected certain people in the play. One of them had managed to detect who Potso was, namely the National Health Act, and so on. Another man had managed to detect who Lucky was, namely the Messiah carrying all the burdens of the world upon his shoulders. Now these are subjective evaluations, and with them there can be a partial release of tension in a given individual. But these are only partial things. We've got to see the play as a whole. Whether the author consciously verbalized the content courageously to himself and then deliberately kept it quiet, or whether it was so frightening that he didn't even dare tell himself, is not important to us. But it doesn't matter what the play is, or indeed what the stimulus is. The reaction to that stimulus can be subjective and personal and private, or it can be subjective and cosmic, universal. Remember that subjectivity is the essence of self-knowledge. The subject is the knower, and to know the subject is to know the cause of the modulations. We have two meanings of the word subjective. Again, we'll use Saturn as a symbol, and we'll use Jupiter. The negative subjective is when a finite observer believes that a truth is what it appears to be by the reactions of his finite vehicle. This is negative subjectivity and gives rise to all the erroneous ideas in the world. That he identifies with a finite vehicle, and that he takes the reactions of his finite vehicle to the stimulus situation as valid for all beings. That's negative subjective judgment. And because of that kind of subjective judgment, many members of rationalists scorn subjectivity as such, which is a very grave psychological error. Because at the opposite end to the Saturnine, or finite and subjective negative mode, there is the Jupiterian, God the Father as supreme subject, who sees within himself not only the private, privated Saturnine negative subjective judgment, but he also sees the cosmic Logos judgment springing out of the tension between this private judgment and the absolute. So we must not fall into that psychological error, and sometimes philosophical error, of thinking that all subjective judgment is bad. Only finite, privated, negative subjective judgment is bad, and it is bad even then, only when it pretends to apply beyond its legitimate sphere, within the realm within the realm of the finite individual. It might be quite correct for that individual to say, like sometimes a sick person may, I feel hot on the back of my hand and cold on the palm of my other hand simultaneously. And this may be a state seen truly by him as finite, private, and a behaviour pattern of his own vehicle. Seen that way, it is subjective and it is still true. But if he then says, all hands are hot on the back because mine is, and it is false. So the essence of the erroneous judgment of the finite is, first, that itself detects something in its vehicle, and second, that it shall illegitimately apply it to other vehicles than itself, or even worse, to the universe as such. Whereas in true subjective judgment, there is awareness of the field, that is the sentient power. And the sentient power is itself the supreme subject, and all the phenomena within it are simply modal operations of itself. And this kind of subjective mode is absolutely true. And absolutely, there is nothing other than this motion of the subject, this subjective awareness. Many philosophical difficulties have arisen through failing to distinguish between the two modes of subjective judgment, the finite negative mode, satta, and the supreme subjective mode of the sentient power, Jupiter, internal to which all these other motions take place.
What's the position of the temporal power mode? Automatically going to be subject to the second death in view of the fact that he's a temporal gatherer.
Yes.
Well, that means to say that his principles are erroneous then.
They must be. Pots are going blind precisely because in closing himself and possessing and accepting and affirming the slavery and enslaving himself, he has put himself in a closed system. And he started this at a certain point in time, and therefore it must have a certain terminal point in time. And here he begins to complain because the whole structure of his world is falling down. And the Babylonians built Babylon. They didn't think it was going to wear out. When the Egyptians built the pyramids, they didn't think that they were going to have a civilization that wouldn't survive the pyramids. When the Greeks and the Romans made their civilizations, they never thought the thing would collapse. They hadn't seen the necessary cyclic nature of temporal processes. They hadn't seen that every finite beginning has a finite end. They hadn't seen that to come into seriality at all means going out of seriality at some point. And therefore, they had precipitated themselves into the certainty of the second death, that is, the dissolution of the gestalt structures, the whole forms, if you like, psychologically the syndrome, the whole complex of symptoms of the society they built. The individual power man, symbolized by the type of pocha, or the chetna, if you like, is mechanical. Because he has committed himself into a relation of subservience to the slave in order to control the slave. He knows that the slave is mechanical. Yet he has to adjust continuously to the mechanical. So that he's always in phase with the mechanical. And so, in effect, there is no bigger slave than the hetman ruler, who, for the sake of the feeling that he is ruling, is forced to sit on his throne and dish out orders.
So, in a way, that only leaves the ruler to have the body of indestructible concept.
But the fool, for Christ's sake, is he who is rejecting all these finite concepts, which are definitions. He functions without definition, without seriality, and therefore immediately from the Zen spirit.
So this is the pure field man.
The pure field man. The man who refuses a finite definition. Not that he doesn't see finites within the field, but that he refuses to accept the definition he sees as valid in any separable sense. He refuses to accept any temporal phenomenon as eternal. He accepts all things as in a state of flux, and he refuses to draw a line that cannot be drawn. Therefore, he's a fool. That is in relation to all those beings who are committed to define and feel that they're very clever to make definitions. They define him as a fool, and he says, all right, I accept the definition, because this fool that you define me as is really said to be a
if we read from the Hebrew, same word, it means power is God. The poem means power is God. Now this is the Hebrew for people. This whom? This poloia, the Greeks. He says power is God, not form is God. Not definition is God, power is God. Power makes definitions, power makes and breaks. The Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. His name is power. Hath thou an arm like mine? And so on. This fool is aware that the will is superior absolutely to all its formulations. It wears, like a woman, the right side of its coat over the left, whereas an intellectual man puts the left side of his coat over the right. And the fool behaves like a woman, according to the formulated man. He's unpredictable, he's unformulable. And he appears to move like a woman, that is by feeling. That is to say, you can't see his reasons. But his reasons are no more than the forms of action posited by his will.
In some peculiar way, mechanical people seem to represent the backcloth of experience for these men. They have no self-direction, have they?
That has been said many a time. It's been said by the Taoists that the fools, and this means the straw dogs, are the instruments whereby the wise perfect themselves. When all the mechanical processes of mechanical men, whether slave men or boss men, whether waiters or otherwise, when all these mechanical processes are seen, embodied and objectified for those who have eyes to see with, then in fact the salvation of the fool, for Christ's sake, depends upon the existence of non-fools, that is, mechanical men. And if he hadn't got these examples of mechanical reflexes in people before him, then he might fall into it. But because they're objectified and clarified before his eyes, then he can avoid it.
Apparently Hitler was only able to carry out his body of ideas through the German people, by his direction of the German people.
That's always so. Every great figure manipulates the mechanical. Removes the mechanical and there is nothing to manipulate. If you said, let us confer the state of free spirit on all beings now, if you succeeded, then you would have absolutely no control over them at all. You couldn't guarantee a cosmos. You couldn't guarantee at all. So if there is to be an order set up, it follows that it must be set up by the reduction of the free to the devil. And those who can see the doming process functioning, objectified before their eyes in people, can, by a process of careful watching and self-control, eliminate those mechanical reflexes from their own activity, which they see objectified in other beings. And thus their freedom depends on the bondage of others. This is why in the vow of the Bodhisattva in Buddhism, the Bodhisattva vows that he will be last in Nirvana, last in heaven. Why does he vow this, really, if he understands it? He knows that if he tries to be first in, he's going to gallop way ahead of everybody and try to perfect himself faster than anybody else. He's going to throw a very big strain on his organism, and he's going to deprive himself of all the experiences that he might have with the lower types. Obviously, if you want to get to heaven very quickly, the first thing to do is go to a theologian and study under him personally, isn't it? Because he's next to heaven. So you go either to our dear Ramsey, or you go to the Vatican, and you apply for permission to sit at the foot and hear the great words of the man next door to heaven. Now, that's the way it would appear to get there first. Have nothing to do with people who know nothing about it. To have something to do with people who know everything about it, and learn. And that would be the best way of not arriving in heaven. Between 12 and 30
Christ is wandering about God knows where and deriving experience of the very lowest orders before he reappears to battle with the rabbis. If you go to all the people who know nothing about God, the convinced atheists, the skeptics, the agnostics and so on, if you go to these people and talk to them, they'll give you more arguments against atheism in 5 minutes than any theologian could do. Because they're so riddled with inconsistencies and they're so articulate about it that they can't help expressing themselves. They clarify for you within a few minutes what a good believer couldn't even begin to conceive. Find yourself a good atheist. Let him explain to you the ground of his atheism. They're generally, if they're good atheists, articulate. They have vocabularies of sorts and they use them with vigour. And in the process, they show themselves totally inconsistent. Whereas if you go to a great believer and find yourself a good archbishop to talk to, and let him explain to you the mystery of the Trinity, you'll feel as if he hasn't been talking about the Trinity at all. Just as in the case of the atheist, you'll feel he hasn't been talking about atheism at all. And so there's this peculiar dialectical fact that if you want to move towards a thing, you should move away from it. And this is the meaning of the Bodhisattva vow, I will be last in. Let me go to the people who know nothing and ask them about it, and I shall find something out. You know this recent space flight lark captivating everybody's imagination. You know that in the phenomena of weightlessness, which they reproduce by various mechanical devices, certain things emerge. You put a man on a plate, suspend it on an air cushion, so that in effect he is frictionless and weightless. You put a dial near him, and you turn this man away from the dial, and then you ask him to turn round and switch something on the dial. Now, because he's standing on a plate, which is suspended on what is for all practical purposes, frictionless base, uncompressed air, as soon as he tries to turn towards the dial, the act of trying to turn towards it pushes him away from it. To every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. The only way you can get to that dial is to try to turn away from it. Now, this is a fact of experiment. We tend not to notice it because we're not in a frictionless environment. We put our feet on the floor and there's friction. So that when we turn towards something, the frictive resistance allows us to turn towards it. Whereas in a frictionless environment, the mere act of trying to turn forces you in the opposite direction. Now this is a deep spiritual truth. At the spiritual level, there is no friction. And therefore, the way to attain anything whatever spiritually is always to move to the opposite. It's this dialectical principle. It's the principle psychologically that if you want it, you can't have it. And if you really don't want it, they'll bring it to you. Whatever it is.
You have the number 11 man, or the Christie's man,
yeah,
on the zodiac. He is the Judas figure, is he?
Not usually. Usually Scorpio would be placed there.
So is this Judas figure the equivalent of the diaphragm, the two forces playing on it?
Well, you'd have to be careful. Who keeps the money bags? Does your diaphragm keep the money bags? Does your belly keep them? Or does your head keep them? You know that Judas is the same as Yehudas. It's the same as the name that he gives. Judas is Yehudas. This is the name of those people. We spell it in various ways, but if we cut this out, you can see Judas there. Now, the idea behind it is that E, A, R, O, U a row of vowels is the name of God, that's pure, free spirit. The moment we introduce a D into it, we introduce that D, Yam, Du. Du means black, even in the Scottish Gaelic. Now, we've introduced a dividing factor. This D, this Dalas, this dividing factor, turns God's name, the Yod, into Yoda. The S at the end symbolizes the issuing force of it. So Yehuda, like Yehudi Benjamin. Yehuda means that this free has now got itself divided. This is the ground of Jewish selectivity, or to be more accurate, Yiddish selectivity. And the introduction of this D converts God into his own betrayer. Judas is no more than that same force which without division would be God, but with the introduction of division betrays the seamless garment. So that any impulse in any people whatever, not merely those people claiming to be the Yids, but in any people whatever, in an individual whatever, wherever there's an impulse, a concept, a feeling, or a desire to divide and separate, to divide in order to conquer the finites, there you have Judas. Now, in the physical economy, there's the head, the heart, the belly. Now, where are the money bags? In the head, money means to count. Where are the bags of that money? Maybe the bags of money are up there, or maybe they're down here, in the omega. If you look at some of the figures, you will find a figure something like this, anciently, and it will probably write the aleph, the alpha, and the omega, in that manner. That omega is the bag's form. Now, in this testicular zone, all the formal content of the experience of the male side of the ancestry is embagged. And this is continuously being positive, divided and separated out. And therefore, Scorpio, who is zodiacally on the genitalia, is in this sense Judas. Because every spermatic force brought out is a separate force in function and can strike back against its source. The son can fight and murder his father. The daughter can despise and refuse to help her mother, and so on. Wherever there's this dividing, separating function, that is Judas. And that destroys the seamless whole. And yet, funnily enough, it has to do this work. What you have to do, that do quickly, says Christ to Judas. Because the absolute field, if in perfect equilibrium, makes nothing, and that is valueless. But if it makes something, it has KBM, close to substance. And that is the ground of division, and that is Judas. So there's this peculiar fact that the absolute continuum precipitates within itself by its own dynamism the function of separativity, and this is Judas.
Well, he seems to stand between the system maker and the matter of immediacy, doesn't he? And he seems to vacillate between the two.
Well, he must do. The seed of the woman shall bruise the serpent's head, and the serpent shall bite him in the heel. A man sets up a business, and that man has children in there. Now his will, and his idea, and his feeling, he hopes have embodied in there, And then he deposits this, and the result is a child. The father now fondly imagines that the child is going to follow in his footsteps. He's going to go in the same business and build it up and keep his father's name on. He confers his own name upon the child and his own business. But the seed of the woman is going to contradict this father's intent. And this father's intent is the serpent will of the father, and the seed of the woman is the son of the mother, and will fight. And the result is that the father's intention is overthrown by the mother. We have two lines, and if you remember our simple diagram, we have mother and father, and that every mother has a father of her own. When father comes to make a child like himself, which is what he wants, mother's father deposits form into that child. And husband and father-in-law never did get on well. And so the conflict between the son and the father-in-law is embodied in the son and the father. And so the seed of the woman from the father's side bruises the head of the intent of the father. If the father had his own way, he would perpetuate his own name and his own business. He'd let it go bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Luckily, wifey does not agree. And certainly, wifey's daddy doesn't agree, because he has another business. So the child gets the benefit of this strange opposition. And the father in the wife is smashing at the husband in the son.